from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Chang Rae Lee made his mark on the literary scene when he was 29 years old with the novel Native Speaker about a Korean-American spy. His Korean roots and his immigrant parents' struggle for assimilation continue to play a role in his work. The Princeton creative writing professor talks with us about his writing and his new dystopian novel, On Such a Full Sea, which envisions a future America frighteningly different and just as frighteningly similar to today's United States. Chang Rae Lee joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. And in this hour, we're joined by novelist Chang Rae Lee, who is, well, a novelist not only of note and acclaim. He's won a number of awards, but he's been on the literary scene since he was 29 with his first novel, Native Speaker, which was about a Korean-American spy and is a Korean-American by descent. His parents were immigrants who came here, and immigration and the struggle for assimilation certainly have played roles in his work. His newest novel is called On Such a Full Sea, and he's also a professor of creative writing at Princeton and is the author of such books as The Surrendered and I mentioned Native Speaker. This is the fifth novel, I think, and it's a dystopian novel.
That's right.
A pre-apocalyptic dystopian novel. I hate to genre-ize things, but good to have you here. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Michael.
Been an admirer of yours for many years now, and they say you can't tell a book by its cover, but this is a limited edition with a three-dimensional slipcase. This may be a trend now for novels. I don't know if so, but they are printing more 3D books. And you've said, actually, that you kind of like this. I mean, you see it as kinetic. You see it as maybe futuristic, tying in a little bit with the content.
I think that was the marketing angle by the powers that be over at the publishing house and at MakerBot. But I just thought it was a cool art object. Aside from the neato quality of the 3D printing of the slipcase, it's sort of neat to think about a book being special again. For me, books are always special. And, you know, I think you probably have special editions.
We share that, yeah.
Yeah, special editions of certain books. But I thought, especially in this age when you can read every book and have it look the same exact way on your Kindle, which is a great convenience and wonderful at the same time, to differentiate a book and particularly, make it something that you might actually want to display.
An object, maybe an objet d'art.
Yeah, exactly.
What is your feeling about audiobooks, though? Just for this always comes up as a kind of.
I really enjoy them. I'm not a commuter. Luckily, I walk to work, so I don't really use audiobooks. But I love the when the acting is good, or I guess the reading. Or it's really acting. It gives another dimension to it. I must admit that the audiobooks of my novels always jar me at first because, of course, it's their interpretation of the language and the cadences and the voice. The timbre and sound of those voices. But it's always sort of thrilling, and so I quite enjoy them.
Well, the voice here, and I have to give you props for this, is sort of a chorus voice. It's a plural voice. It's first person plural. And it's challenging to write in that voice. I mean, it's so much easier just to use a first person or a third person omniscient than a first person plural.
Well, those first person or third person omniscient would have been, that's the instant decision, right, that one could make. I could have Fan, who's the hero of the story, tell her own story. But I very quickly got onto the first person plural because the book was also about community and the sense of community and how not just it, how it describes itself, but how the story of Fan and the engagement with her exploits begins to change the community and the very telling.
It's really about, in fact, on that level, how stories and myth and even legends for that matter, are formed.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they come about really, we always think of legends as sort of handed down on from on high, but really they're incremental, aren't they?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they come bit by bit around the, you know, the proverbial campfire. And each time it's told for the particular desires, wishes, sensitivities of that particular teller. Why do we need biographies of Abraham Lincoln every, you know, 15 years, right? I mean, there'll be hundreds. Well, obviously it's the particular writer, but it's also the time.
And right? Its point of view, right. I mean, which is what you've done here with the first person plural. And you talk about Fan. This is a protagonist. She's a diver in a farm fish facility, actually a labor facility in what was Baltimore. This is not your David Simon or Barry Levinson or John Waters Baltimore. This is a place called Bemore, which is really a futuristic world that is essentially put there for technology and for agriculture for people who are, shall we say, in this very class-rigid society that you envision, the beneficiaries of that.
Yeah, yeah, and this facility, Bemore, is you know, not that special a place. It really is. It's meant to just function well. So the folks that live there have traded a measure of freedom, both political and social. They don't really want to venture beyond the walls because it's somewhat dangerous to do so, or at least they believe it is.
And it is.
you know, a life that is pretty prescribed, pretty safe, you know, a cloister of security. But, of course, in that cloister, there's a little bit of deadness, a little. And I think once the story begins and we follow Fan's trail, you know, there's a little bit of a breaking. You know, a little bit of a rising of feeling about what are we doing here and how do we fit into this place and what have we given up?
Where did the idea come from, the genesis for this? You know, I was wondering, on the one hand, if you had read a lot of dystopian novels, there's certainly, I think of Margaret Atwood or Cormac McCarthy. I did in reading your book, even thought of Orwell and Bradbury. But also, I suddenly got a interesting clue, I thought. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I read where you had studied initially at the University of, or after you went to Yale, you went to the University of Oregon, and I couldn't help thinking about a famous story by Ursula Le Guin. You know the story I'm speaking about, O'Malley's, the ones who go
right.
away from O'Malley's?
Yes.
Which is Salem, Oregon, backwards.
Yeah, that's right.
And I thought, was this a catalyst in some ways, or other dystopian literature?
I wouldn't say that I'm the biggest fan of dystopian literature, but I just love the great examples of those books, all the ones you mentioned. And, you know, as a schoolboy and as a college student and as an adult, you know, I'd read the McCarthy book and Ishiguro and Atwood and... But, you know, I tried not to think about those things when I was writing On Such a Full Sea. I tried to focus on the particular human questions and moments that arise in this scenario. And really, it's, you know, once you have a premise and then begin extrapolating, you kind of sort of follow along with it without any heed to, you know, any kind of form, I think. You know,
but there's a lot of narrative drive here. I mean, really must have, as an author, gotten into this story in a big way.
Well, I did. And I've always enjoyed telling tales, but this one particularly because, you know, wherever she goes, you're discovering a little tiny world, whether it's in the world of a village or the world of a room. You know, one example is inside the Exalted Charter Village, this woman keeps girls as pets. And I just thought it's obviously really fun to think about that scenario, but even more fun and chilling sometimes to get into it and to think about and to extract all the kind of human behavior and expression that goes on there.
In that sense, it's kind of like almost a traditional buildings roman or an episodic novel. I mean, I thought about Huckleberry Finn, you know, he's out and suddenly all these different adventures and people who are good people, bad people, I mean, meeting all sorts of on the continuum or on the spectrum. But you mentioned the charters. I mean, this is a very class-divided society you envision here. It's class-rigid, and the charters is where, you know, people who are essentially protected by their affluence or their prosperity or whatever you want to call it live, although they live on the edge. And I wonder, you know, what was the cauldron in you? Because there is a sense here of real class division.
Yes.
I mean, that brought this to bear along with the story and the narrative drive.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's something that has been sort of, you know, itching. It's just been something that's been a little bit of a friction in my gut. In the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years. And listen, you know, I live in a charter village of my own, you know, in the university setting. You know, it's sort of this ideal place. And I think one of the things that I worry about sometimes is about losing sight and vision about what's outside and what goes on outside, you know.
Well, I read, actually, I won't get back to the novel, but I read a piece you wrote about your mother and her difficulty with oxtails in a butcher shop, and it's a very moving piece, you know, about, I think what the catalyst was about, wasn't it about using Korean-only language signs, and your mother just struggling as an immigrant with language. I mean, in a sense, you've got the divisions that you're talking about, which we're talking about now, which are class divisions, economic divisions, but also divisions of those people who are working in labor camps or who are simply set off because of their immigrant status or because they're brought here essentially to work.
Sure.
Or came here essentially to work.
Sure. And I've always been, you know, and you bring up the example of my mother that I wrote about. I'm so conscious of the idea that someone isn't just someone. It's someone in a context. Mm-hmm. And the context is so critical in determining how that person acts and reacts and in turn thinks of themselves. So self-conception, you know, we'd like to believe that our self-conception is, you know, somehow immutable or original or fundamental to us. But really it's not. And I think the immigrant knows this because, you know, and what I remember of my mother is that she's passed a long time now, but she was someone else in Korean and Korean culture than when she was on the street, say, of a New York suburb. She was two very different people. Even her posture changed. And that's the sort of thing that I've always been attuned to. And I think a lot of that comes out in this book. You know, this book is about, as you say, a certain kind of, you know, serial circumstance and how that circumstance and all the characters who inhabit that circumstance have been formed and deformed.
It's not only a shift for you, though, to go to a dystopian novel. It's also a shift to go to a protagonist who's Chinese as opposed to Korean.
Yeah, you know, but I think of her both as Chinese and then totally not, you know. I think this book is certainly ethnically interested in certain ways about how Bmore thinks of itself, because the folks in Bmore are predominantly the descendants of Chinese settlers. So they have it's an Asian-inflected society.
I mean, how do you respond, though, generally to the category that's often used about Asian Americans? I mean, because Koreans, in terms of you know, their culture are so different than Vietnamese, than Chinese, than Laotians, Cambodians. I mean, and yet this whole continent is used. I don't know that it's used about any other people or any other continent, really.
No, I don't think
we're talking about NAFTA in the last hour. But,
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, who could be more different than Japanese and Koreans? Very different peoples. But I suppose so I'm uncomfortable with it in the sense that I think it's very broad and usually not a very satisfying or interesting way to describe someone.
Talking again with Chengrui Li, his new book is On Such a Full Sea. He's also author of the award-winning novel Native Speaker and The Surrendered, among others, and is professor of creative writing at Princeton and directs its creative writing program. And we should mention that Gary Steingart was one of his students, in fact, a mentee of his who will be with us Wednesday. You're going along similar trade I said trade routes. I'm back in NAFTA again, but appearance routes. This is really, I mean, in a sense, what was in your gut, what you describe as being in your gut or irritating you, it's just division and lack of mobility.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is, and this is, you know, I'm no policy analyst, I'm not an economist, but I get the sense that we all feel that there's been a skewing that's a little different these days, that wealth is being accumulated in a way that has never been before, which is not what this book is against. It's not about the accumulation of wealth in any way. It's about the entrenchment of class, the entrenchment of a certain socio or a socioeconomic destiny that, that people might have in a very different future.
Well, I don't know if your intention is to be oracular, though, you know, there is this notion that often novelists can see the future, whether they're writing a dystopian novel or just a regular novel, that somehow you can, I mean, Blake was a great believer, you know, come in touch with forces that you didn't know on a mundane level you could. But there's a lot of darkness in this novel. There's a lot of violence in this novel.
Well, I think there's a lot of violence because there's a skewed morality in the novel. You know, all these folks are, whether they're, you know, left to their own devices in the counties and just scraping to get by, or whether they're in a regulated environment in Beemore, or whether they have all the resources and luxuries of life in the charter villages, they're all deeply unsettled in their souls, I think. They're all struggling to find a different path. And I think in that struggle, weird things can happen. Weird desires can arise.
In that anarchic and almost frontier area that you write about, I almost found myself thinking of Pakistan, you know, I mean, like that.
Well, it's any area that where there's no oversight, there's no regulation, there's no authority, and that we've ceded, we ceded all that to just, you know, human need and you know, just the requirements of survival. So it's not necessarily always a dangerous place, but it's but danger is always around the corner. Well, as it is in our own lives, of course, you know. But there, it's especially pointed.
But I was struck. And by the way, you were given the honor of being named one of the 20 writers of the future by the New Yorker, and there was a piece of the New Yorker, I guess it was an interview with you, where you said, you're still hopeful about the future, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I am. You know, this book is, I think, a hopeful book in a way. You know, it's sure, lots of bad things happen. But there's a seam through it that that I think is persistently positive. And that seam is the character of Fan. You know, she's the one who, she doesn't say much. You know, she's not endowed with that kind of expression. But in her form, you know, her very pure, small form, she's this, I don't know, this elemental thing. And I think all the people in the book, and maybe myself as the writer, were looking for something like that. You know, not someone who would explain to us all the ways in which we have gone wrong and where we should go right, but just sort of be. And I know it's sort of a Zen thing, I suppose.
It is, yeah. What about if somebody says to you, Fan is a cipher?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I don't quite see it that way. She's someone who may not even recognize us. Hmm. And she may not even recognize her story. She's just on her path and on her mission, which is to find her boyfriend.
That's what sets her off on the quest.
Right.
Her boyfriend, Reg, disappears, we should mention. And that gives you a lot of narrative drive.
Sure. And she just has a mission, a very simple one. But what the narrator and we as the reader start to put on her adventures is, of course, you know, a mirror on us as well. So she's really more... in that way, a reflection of us as she moves through this world.
Cheng Weili's new novel is On Such a Full Sea. Can you read something for us?
Sure. Maybe I thought I'd do a little section that describes Fan.
Great.
She's a diver in the fish tanks. You know, this facility raises, in part, fish for the charter villages, and she's a diver who cleans the tanks. Once submerged, a diver is not easily seen. Given all the fish in the water, naturally as many healthy fish are raised as possible, she is a mere shadow among them, trained to do her tasks quickly and unobtrusively. That is why she uses no special breathing apparatus aside from a snorkel, compressed gases causing too much of a disturbance. Fearful fish are not happy fish. The diver is not, quote, one of them, but is part of the waterscape from the time they are hatchlings. And they see her customary form and the repeated cadence of her movements and the gentle motor of her flippered feet that must come to them like a motherly lullaby, a dream song of refuge, right up to the moment of harvest. The diver is there at harvest, of course, and sees to it that the very last of them finds its way into the chute. And it is only then, for the span of the few hours while the tank is being cleaned and filtered before the next generation of hatchlings is released, that the water is clear of activity, that the diver is alone.
Yeah, wow. I mean, it's amazing. I can take just a passage like that and an image of somebody diving into a fish tank and turn it into poetry. It's really, really well done. You work a lot. I mean, I think once I read you describe your writing sentences as almost pathological.
Yeah, it's my particular disease. I've always worked that way, and I'm often asked why that is. I don't know. It partly because maybe I grew up writing on a computer, and I can rework the sentences over and over and over again without too much trouble. But maybe it's just partly my sense of the language. And
That's what Philip Roth said writing is, you know, just turning a sentence around and around.
All around, and that's exactly right. But for me, you know, the game and the task is not just to tell a story, but, you know, to find its music. I started out in writing as a poet, not a very good one.
Makes two of us.
but what I always was a lover of poetry, and I loved the prose writers who had this immediate and deep music to their and in different forms. But that deep music always spoke to me, and that's how I see the story as revolving and going forward.
Who especially touches you on that deep music level?
Well, all different kinds of folks. When I was a boy, I loved Hemingway. You know, I loved his sentences, and I couldn't believe that I was reading these spare sentences that seemed to hold so much. At the same time, I loved the early stories of Joyce. You know, that kind of lyricism that
Dubliners.
Yes, there are moments in Dubliners across the stories that are, you know, some of the most exquisite language English has ever seen. Then also, you know, I was a big fan of Whitman's Leaves of Grass. And even though I didn't quite grasp when I was younger all the things that he was talking about, just the volumes, the exuberance, the way that he wanted to contain everything with his voice and with his, you know, with the voice of his soul, that I found really inspiring.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with author Chang-Rae Lee, whose newest book is On Such a Full Sea. And we do invite your involvement in this program. We're certainly going to get into a lot of issues here, which he gets into in his work, immigration and assimilation. We talk a bit about class divisions. In fact, you may want to join us. I'll be talking with him also, I hope, in the course of this hour about teaching creative writing. He kind of fell into that profession, and we'll find out what he feels about it. But some of you may want to join the conversation, and if you do, we welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your joining the conversation, so please feel free to do it. His fifth novel, a dystopian novel about America's future, named one of the 20 best writers by The New Yorker and a recipient of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation Pen Award, as well as other awards. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. But again, feel free to join us with Chang-Rae Lee. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with writer Chang-Rae Lee, who is the author of a number of books. His fifth book is a dystopian novel. It's called On Such a Full Sea, and talking about a whole range of issues with him, and you are certainly welcome to join the conversation. I was talking a little bit off air just about teaching writing, and I was saying that it can be demoralizing for not only students but obviously teachers, given the fact that I don't know if there are as many aspiring novelists as there were when you were growing up or I was growing up, but there are still aspiring writers, and it's getting increasingly more difficult not only to publish but to find an audience. Social media is being used, supposedly, but at the same time, the difficulties and the obstacles are formidable. And I'm just wondering how you either embrace this or and what kind of challenges you face just as a writing teacher. I know you're a good teacher from everything I've read and from everything I can intuit. But you've got students who have high hopes and you have declining enrollments in humanities and you have, you know, a real crisis in the humanities.
You know, I at Princeton I teach undergrads. I used to teach graduate students who are, of course, closer to their professional aspirations. The undergraduates I teach are, you know, they're wonderful. They're, many of them are fine writers. And they're in the class not because they maybe just want to be writers, but, you know, they're exploring. But at the same time, I know that those who are very interested in writing as a career, you know, it's hard to say to them that the world is open. I felt like when I was graduating college in the late 80s, that was a sort of a boom time. Publishers were looking for first novelists and giving good advances. And you could at least, you know, hope to make a little bit of a career of it. And now I think you're right. It's a lot more difficult. I think they're very brave, but from what I see, there'll always be the urge to write. There'll be plenty of writers. There'll be plenty of books published in whatever format. The question is, will the readers? And I do believe there'll be readers for all of this. The question is, what is how the readers will value this material? You know, what value they'll assign to it. You know,
the difficulty is, I mean, for young people now to sit down and read a novel is a major test. They email, they text, everything has become abbreviated and shortened. Mm-hmm. You know, you say to them, gee, reading Dickens, reading Chiang Rai-li, mm-hmm. you know, this will benefit you tremendously. And they may even believe it in some part of themselves, but they're used to things coming much more coded and much more short.
Well, I think that's true, although there feels like there's this other urge that's arising and people are looking for something a little bit more substantial, a little bit more sustained in terms of an experience. I think all that stuff, all the, you know, how we're peppered by all this stuff that moves through us so quickly. I think we're getting so used to it that now we're looking for something else.
The pendulum will swing back.
It always does. It always will. And one of the great things about long-form fiction is that it almost becomes a physical thing because you have to spend so much time in it. And I think that people are craving physicality instead of virtuality. You know, so I think it will turn.
That's a good axiom. Let's crave physicality instead of virtuality. I like that. What do you get out of teaching?
I get refreshed. The energy of my students, as I mentioned, their bravery. They're so brave. I would never get into a class and sit around and allow people to critique it.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that may be one of the problems with creative writing classes. You know, you're being critiqued by your peers for the most part. And I'm reading Steingart's autobiography now, or his memoir, and he was your student, and he said, you know, he was encouraged by people like you, but not necessarily by his fellow students. They thought he was way out there.
Well, you take a grain of salt with everything that you hear. It's more about the process. You know, I've never been a believer that I'm actually teaching writing. I teach reading. And so a lot of the things that we discuss in class are not student work, but professional work. And the student work we discuss, I want them to have the same rigor and the same kind of focus on it, and to practice their ways of unpacking the material, you know, close reading, trying to understand, you know, all the things that the writers, you know, levering and unlevering. And so I think that's just good practice for anything. And if I can, in my class, you know, a very small percentage will end up as career writers, but they're all, I hope, going to be informed and avid readers as we go forward. And I think that's what it's all about.
And here's Neil. Neil, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, how many novels are there American novels that touch on Koreans or the Korean-American experience. The only one I know of is The Manchurian Candidate. I can't help but wonder if you ever read that, because I don't think that's very typical of Koreans or the Korean-American experience. Are there many novels that touch on Koreans or Korean-Americans?
Yeah, I used to read a guy named Richard Kim. You're probably familiar with him?
Sure, sure. That's the 50s, and he was one of the earlier ones. There's even before that, in the 20s, there are Korean-American novels. But these days, you know, I just say type in Korean American novels into the internet, and you'll be amazed how many younger writers there are. You know, I'm of the probably the first generation after 1965. I'm almost 50, so I'm probably on the older end of the Korean Americans writing today. And you know, I see them, a lot of them, because a lot of the galleys of their first novels come through my desk, and it's usually about one a week. So
when you hear Korean American writers, you think always South Korea, don't you?
Well, I mean, naturally.
But there's a great North Korean writer who wrote about North Korea, who is now a Stanford creative writing professor, won a Pulitzer. But this was an American who went to North Korea, Adam Johnson.
Yeah. Sure.
And by the way, feel free to join us by phone at 866-733-6786. Also interested in maybe hearing some stories from some of our listeners that we touched upon. That is this whole quandary and mystery of Asian American identity and why it's bracketed under the continent, as if somehow we're uploading all of these different and multivalent identities into one single, well, homogenous identity, Asian American. And they do that with literature, too, I'm afraid. You know, I mean, that becomes a genre. You're an Asian American writer, so is Amy Tan, so, you know, is
Gish Jen,
Ishiguro, yeah, and so forth. But we do welcome your calls. It's 866-733-6786, or your emails, forum@kqed.org, or your web postings, kqed.org/forum, and click on this post, click on this segment. Faiza, I think this was a former student of mine, it's a Pakistani name, says, who are his influences as a writer, and why did he decide to write a dystopian novel? Well, I think we've kind of answered both of those. You were talking about the music of different writers, but why you decided to write a dystopian novel goes back to what you were saying about you had something in your craw, which is the best reason to write a novel, I guess, isn't it?
It has to be the reason. There's nothing else. I mean, you know, sometimes that craw is an aesthetic problem or question.
So aesthetic or ascetic?
Aesthetic for me. I'm not an ascetic.
Most novelists, serious novelists, are ascetic.
You're responding to, you know, the things that that are giving you anxiety. I mean, that's really what you know, I think of the basis of a lot of art is just this feeling that something's just a little amiss or a lot amiss, and that you haven't yet formulated a response to it that's satisfying.
Was it difficult for you to write these violent scenes?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I think what I allow is I don't see them. I guess I don't see them as violent so much as sort of flashes of light, and they kind of clear the deck in a way of that moment, which I like, and that's what I see it as. So I see them sort of aesthetically, rather than trying to get into the details of you know, what happens really.
Here's a listener who wants to know if you were influenced by The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson.
No, I haven't read that book. I met Neil recently, but I haven't read that book.
And we should mention, by the way, that you can actually meet our guest, Chang Ray Lee. He'll be at the bookshop in Santa Cruz tonight at 7 p.m. And let me go to another caller. That's Nate. Good morning.
Hi there. Mr. Lee, on a personal note, I had to read Just Your Life for AP English in high school, and I remember it well and sort of stayed with me.
Well, that's great.
I was wondering if maybe you could comment on how or why you, or what your opinion is about sort of the durability of literature as an artistic expression in a medium that, especially right now, it seems like the dystopian, our culture seems fixated on it. And I wonder as a writer what that means to you.
Well, I think literature is very durable. it constantly renews us when we read. You know, you can think back to the particular books that really moved you, and we're all different, of course, so different books do that. But it renews your sense of how you are, right? It revises and refreshes an idea about your place in your particular society. So if I go back and read a book that I loved, Germinal by Emile Zola, for example, about coal mining in northern France, a really wonderful book. Some critics say over melodramatic, but I thought it was this hugely emotional book. He brings us into the mines, the black maws of the earth. Of course, I'm learning about that place and time and those issues, but boy, aren't those issues the same issues that we're lots of the same things that we're having now. You know, human history is always a cycle. It's always repeating itself. We forget that. But in reading literature, we can understand how we're connected over time, over spans of great time, to the struggles of the very first peoples.
There's that universality again that your professor Harold Bloom, when you were at Yale, became certainly a strong advocate of. But also, when you talk about a writer like Zola, I mean, I think of about another novel, his Les Sommoirs, where the observation power of the novelist is so great. I mean, just in terms of being able to help people to see.
Yes, and that's exactly what a certain passage will do. You see the world in a different way, and that different way isn't just optical, right? It seeps back into then how you're going to see other things. And so when I was talking about Hemingway earlier, the spareness of his language, I began to kind of imprint that upon, certain moments in my life, and to try to tease out a certain kind of feeling. So I think it's literature has both a very public and very private function, and I think the best art does that.
Let's talk about sea illness, which plays a considerable role in this novel and also has to do with whatever you may be envisioning about the future. I assume you were thinking about some of the consequences of environmental pollution and the like.
Yeah, it's a sort of cancer-like illness hard to pin down for the people who are struggling with it. But everyone in the world of On Such a Full Sea will die of the so-called sea illness. It's inevitable, and of course, it's inevitable because they live in the environment. It's in the atmosphere. It's in their very strands. And the reason why...
You think of Love Canal and all that.
Yeah. Well, think of West Virginia today. So we're, it's something that's, to this point in the world, inescapable. So that's why the Chargers are so involved and so intent on trying to isolate the purest things to ingest. And that's why Fan's boyfriend, Reg, is believed to have disappeared. It's because he is one of the rare people who, looking at his genetic panel and his blood panel, will not develop C. So he's this very rare creature.
That's a little bit like Ishiguro. I mean, in a different sense, in his dystopian novel, it's all people have been cloned and they have a very limited lifespan. That's
right.
It, yeah.
Right. And so, there's so much, there's almost a fetishization of health in this novel, because everyone knows that they're doomed.
Do you think maybe that's tied in with all this foodie stuff and all the concern about the health of food and what you eat?
A little bit. And I'm just as, I can be accused of that as much as anyone else. I think that, we're cutting it so fine now. And in trying to figure out all the ways in which we can, have this just the right amalgam of nutrients and beneficial sorts of drugs that will do what for us, I'm not sure. I mean, it's all a mystery, right? I mean, in the end, every week there's a different study, contradictory study about what's good for you and what's bad for you. And in the end, it's a mystery. In the end, I think it's the process that we enjoy so much, the talking about it.
That's what we do here. We talk a lot about that subject. We're talking again with Chang-Rae Lee this hour, and he's the author of On Such a Full Sea. He'll be in Santa Cruz tonight at the bookshop at 7 p.m., and a listener writes, I appreciate your guest's comments about the music of language, and I'm curious to know if he studies music to learn more from that metaphor, and if so, what is he listening to?
Yeah, I'm not a student of music, but I love, you know, two things that I like, especially before and after working. I don't listen to music during work, but I love listening to Baroque music. Because of it, it feels like it's really charging my brain. And then afterwards, I love listening to jazz and soul. I love the improvisational quality of it within a structure, and that for me feels like what I'm trying to do with the writing is that within some basic guidelines. Trying to be as free as possible within it.
That's the form, but does it creep into actually the sound of the language or the cadences of the language?
Absolutely. You know, I'll get to part of a sentence and I'll maybe the in terms of content, I might want to use one word, but I'm always searching for the word that will also fill out the voice of that sentence.
So you say the sentences aloud then over and over again?
Constantly. Yeah. Constantly. And my wife will tell you that when I'm working well, she'll just hear this murmur where I'm just murmuring the sentences to myself because I'm really just hearing them in my head. And I think that's when things aren't going right, I'm just typing.
Here's a listener who says, how difficult was it for Mr. Chang to write from the point of view of a female? Well, he writes more from the point of view, as we said, of the community. But what about the idea of, well, writing with a female protagonist?
Well, this protagonist is younger too. She's 16, and people have asked me that about this book. I have two teenage daughters, and those are my only children, and so I live in a house of a house of women and growing women, and so I think I have a quite a sensitivity to you know, not that they're totally representative of what teenage girls are, but certainly range over a lot of it. so I feel fairly comfortable thinking about what a young girl of 16 might feel and see.
Either of your daughters dive?
They used to. You know, the kind of diving you see in the Olympics.
Right. I assumed it wasn't in fish tanks. Yeah.
They're not abalone divers.
Right.
So.
Abalone's harder to get. Here's Martha, who writes, thanks so much for having Chang Rae Lee as your guest. He is a master with language and creating characters that reveal their souls. The Surrendered was amazing. The characters were written with such understanding. Thank you so much for your books. And another listener, Stella, asks, why is melodrama diminished as a genre? Well, it's really a subgenre. But anyway, she says, why? It was very powerful in telling of human suffering, yet our lives are melodramatic. They are not heroic nor romantic. I remember having this discussion about melodrama with actually with a couple of rather famous authors, not to drop names. But, you know, it becomes something David Foster Wallace, to drop a big name, actually said the same thing. What's wrong with melodrama?
Well, you know, I don't know what's wrong with melodrama. There's something called K-dramas, Korean dramas, that are hugely popular the world over, and they are so melodramatic. And I think we love the overwrought, you know, at some points, in not all the time, but in some point in our browsing and our in our tastes. I think it satisfies something deep in us.
Bring another caller on, and that's you, Jill. Hi. Welcome.
Hi. I was listening to an interview with Gary Shengart, and he gave Mr. Lee a lot of credit for really helping to edit his novel down and make it more presentable and more focused. And I know Mr. Lee has really – I've read that he's got a really intense editing process himself for his own work, and I wonder if he takes a different approach when he's helping other authors prepare their manuscript.
Yeah, I with Gary's manuscript, you know, it was he's so brilliant. You know, his mind works so fast and is going in all these different directions, and it's such a full on performance whenever he writes. And one of the things that I worked on with him was honing it a little bit so that we wouldn't get so taken by the performance that we'd forget what he was really interested in, which was, you know, all the sort of more soulful stuff underneath all the comedy and satire. which is really what's driving a lot of Gary's work. So it really depends on the writer and the piece. You know, it's hard to say in the abstract what I do. Each piece seems to me, each piece of writing and each writer has his own or her own approach. And when I'm a teacher, I try my best to understand what that approach is in its ideal form. And then try to ask the writer certain questions about, well, how are you going to get to that form? For me, because I'm not trying to impose anything on my students.
Well, I'm not trying to impose anything, but it occurs to me Steingart wrote a futuristic novel, and now you've written one. Steingart had a kind of fixation on Korean women. you write about Korean women. I don't know if these things are symbiotic at all, but I can't help
observing. We're blood brothers, you know, brothers of and comrades in arms, and so there are reasons why we're friends.
And what about when students say, and you hear this almost as a kind of boilerplate platitude, I'm looking for my voice. I want to find my voice. You know, it almost sounds like something that, you know, they should go to the lost and found or whatever. But that you know, often pick up on that kind of axiom of teaching a student of writing to find his or her voice.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of that notion. You know, I think it's like you want to find yourself and then you feel like you have to go to, I don't know, Bhutan or something like that. It may happen, it may not. I mean, it's usually not something you find. It's usually something that comes up after, you know, a long time, a lot of work, a lot of reading, a lot of study, a lot of writing. And then suddenly you realize at some point, or someone helps you realize that you, say, might have a certain tendency in language or a certain tendency towards a certain kind of form, a certain tendency of how you observe characters. And that, in the end, becomes maybe something that's appealing. But it's not. The voice is there, but it's still nascent. It's not formed yet. It's not as if, you know, it's there waiting, like in a mine, and you just have to pull it out, and there it is. It's being formed as you look for it. It's both those things.
Struck in reading your novel by a couple of questions that. Maybe just impertinent, but there's a sense of an obvious quest in the novel and the admiration of the collective we that's telling the story for Fan. And yet things happen to Fan. She doesn't have that much agency. And I guess, you know, one could argue that she's made into this some heroic or iconic figure in despite the fact that she has no agency.
No, she doesn't have any. There's a line in the book What happened to Fan mostly happened to her.
Yeah, exactly.
I quite like that idea. You know, she's not Joan of Arc. What she is, though, is someone who is willing to put herself into a place that others are not willing to be put.
She's brave, like you said about your students.
Yeah, she's simply, you know, and brave in a simple way. She doesn't have an agenda. She doesn't have some philosophy behind what she's doing. She's there, and that in this society, in this world, is something that that's I think rare. I mean, she has an you know, she's like this atom, you know, she can't be split in this, at least in this physical reality.
I thought you were saying ADAM,
yeah.
ATOM.
Yeah, and that for people is just amazing. And you know, could this character exist in a non-dystopic, you know, totally realistic fiction? Well, maybe not. Although I never, you know, you never can say
it's not important. Yeah. I mean, it's your imagination, and I wonder what your imagination saw because you're envisioning a whole system here. What's behind the system? What's the power? You know, what powers it be, if you will?
Well, it's called the Directorate. But I'm not. I don't go into it very much. It's almost something that's a figment, perhaps, of all the people who have ceded themselves to some higher authority that they believe exists and has control. I think in the book, when people are waiting for some kind of sign from an authoritative body, they never get it. So in fact, the directorate in this novel, although mentioned, never really does anything. which I think is my feeling that most of the things that we bring upon ourselves and feel constrained by are self-originating.
I thought of, quite honestly, the director, Godot. I mean, it's something you're waiting for, but it's invisible to you, and you have to go out and do your own whatever you're doing. You
know, and all the things and all the things it becomes is just only from you. Its power is in its absence.
Here's Leah, who writes, "I'm a big fan of Mr. Lee's work. I was surprised to read reviews that suggested this new book is science fiction, but hearing this interview does not seem science fiction-y at all. Was it daunting to write about the future? Did Mr. Lee feel compelled to delve into technical research about the science of future stuff?"
I thought to myself, well, should I? And then very quickly I decided, no, I'm not going to do that. I didn't want this book to get technical at all. It's not a manual, an owner's manual of the future. It's not that sort of book.
It's not Gary Steingart's.
No, and you know, he gets into it quite a bit, but ultimately his book is as all I think literature is. You know, it's concerned with human possibility, and once you get away from that, then you're just getting into the mechanics.
But I still remember those contraptions in his book, you know, where you can go into a bar, say a singles bar, and read somebody's blood pressure and find out what their net worth is and all that. I mean, that may be the future after all. And you may be writing about the future here as well. You are, in fact, I think, as well as the present. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The novel, again, On Such a Full Sea, Chang Ray Lee's new novel. He's professor of creative writing at Princeton and directs its creative writing program. And he will also be in Santa Cruz this evening at 7 o'clock at the bookshop. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We certainly enjoy hearing from you, so let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.